I think a lot of us look at this and say, maybe it's a worthwhile trade-off. My data for a free app that is extremely useful to me. Am I wrong there?
Yeah, you're quite wrong, I think. We're going to just hand over control of our lives to these people who then can decide that if they don't like what is coming out of our mouths, they can press a button and shut down our accounts and decide that, oh, this person can't interact in the economy anymore. Or this person isn't allowed to have a voice on the internet anymore.
Greg, I want to know, you know, what keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night is having caffeine or chocolate too late. Tried not to be kept up at night is what I'm trying to say. But in the context of this conversation is the manipulation of events for nefarious reasons. When an event happens, like a big natural disaster, or whether it's a terrorist attack, or whether it is, for example, an outbreak of a disease, those kinds of events can be used to shape policy and to shape society in ways that can be negative and detrimental to society and beneficial to a select few. So those kinds of things do worry me. And that's why these technologies are a big deal, whether they're centralized technologies or decentralized technologies. And the choices that we make when we decide which of these types of technologies we use will affect our future, because they will determine whether we're using platforms that are easily manipulated or not. And I think we should be using platforms that are not easily manipulated.
How do you keep yourself from, like, doom spiraling once you know all this?
Oh, that's easy. I always make sure that my feed is half full of doom and half full of rainbows and lollipops. And kittens, for example, yeah.
Good. Okay, kittens is the, yeah, that's a good solution to everything, is kittens. So I want to talk a little bit about kind of, like, the world we're living in. So I've heard these terms floating around the internet. I've heard techno-feudalism. I've heard surveillance capitalism. I don't know if you've heard these, like, what do they mean to you? And, like, what is the world that we live in, according to you?
What these terms refer to are this idea that there are these big companies that are owned by high-profile billionaires who are the feudal overlords. And they are using surveillance capitalism, in other words, this way of making money by selling data to create these social networks that they rule over, basically. Some of these companies, for example, might want to add more and more features. They want to become more and more a part of your life. So they want to insert themselves into your interactions with other people. And they want to do this for not just the conversations that you're having with people, but also the purchases that you make with other people. And in order to then participate in society, you have to use their app. They're a proprietary, closed source, surveillance-ridden, manipulation-full app in order to participate in all of society, which I think is a little bit bonkers. You know, that's basically saying that, okay, we're going to just hand over control of our lives to these people who then can decide that if they don't like what is coming out of our mouths, they can press a button and shut down our accounts and decide that, oh, this person can't interact in the economy anymore, or this person isn't allowed to have a voice on the internet anymore. So that's kind of the idea of techno-feudalism and what people don't want, I think.
Is that the world we live in?
It's definitely going in that direction here in America. That is the world that people live in China, for example, where they have this everything app, WeChat, I think it's called. And that app is used for almost everything. And some of the people in Silicon Valley think this is a bright idea that they want to introduce to the West, where there's this one app that everybody has to use to do every single thing. And they get to decide what everybody else, you know, is allowed to say and think and believe and do. And that doesn't seem like a bright future to me, because it's very rare when a single person is able to micromanage a million people's lives, right? Like, that's not how things are supposed to work.
What's the world that we could live in, like the one with more kittens?
So the world with more kittens is where power is decentralized. It's where a group of people is doing something on behalf of another group of people that feels well represented. And that only happens in more decentralized systems, where the number of representatives and the number of people who are being represented is much smaller. So you don't have this few ruling over the many effect. In those kinds of systems, responsibilities are divvied up in a much better and fairer way, and people actually are more likely to see and know their representatives and be able to actually interact with them and have meaningful conversations and meaningful interactions. And in order to live in that world, we have to understand this and choose to use decentralized systems.
I think part of the reason that we're all wrapped up in using a lot of these centralized systems that do spy on us is we're kind of making a trade, right? So, like, I use, like, Gmail and Google Docs. I'm getting a free piece of software. And, like, yeah, I'm aware that they're able to do kind of whatever they want with my data. But that's kind of how I'm paying for it, right? So I think a lot of us look at this and say, maybe it's a worthwhile trade-off. My data for a free app that is extremely useful to me. Am I wrong there?
Yeah, you're quite wrong, I think. And I'll explain why I think it's very incorrect to think that way. Or maybe I shouldn't be so strong there. Maybe I shouldn't say you're wrong. But what I would say is that you need to really consider the choice that you're making. Let me put it that way. Yeah. From my perspective, it feels very wrong, and I'll explain why. Because I don't see any advantage that you're getting there for yourself personally. So that's why I think it's not a bright move to make. Gmail, for example, sure, you get free email, but on a daily basis, how much do you spend for, say, a cup of coffee, right? Like maybe $3 or $4 or something like that. You could be paying for a different company, like either StartMail or Tutanota or ProtonMail. You could be paying a monthly fee of about the price of a cup of coffee and get a much better email experience, much more private email experience, and not contribute to the centralization of a decentralized protocol like email on the internet. Because what are the knock-on effects of your choice to use Gmail? Well, because so many people use Gmail, you are then giving Google the power to centralize a decentralized protocol. And then what can they do? And what have they done? They can then decide, well, we have all this power over email. We can now decide who can do email. I've actually seen situations where a person sends somebody email to a Gmail address, and that email just doesn't show up. It doesn't show up in their inbox. It doesn't show up in their junk mail folder. It's just not there. Why? Is it because Google has, you know, blacklisted this person? Is it because Google has a bug? Well, we don't even know because we can't even really reach Google Gmail tech support. You know, go, try to do that. It's really hard. So why should we put ourselves in that position? That's what happens when there is this, you know, this effect where the whole herd of people chooses to use this one entity. That's not a good position to put ourselves. It's better if there's an actual real free market that's going on and people are able to use from different email providers. And the more the merrier.
It's like we're living in something out of a Kafka novel, you know?
Yeah, well, we've placed ourselves in that position by deciding to use these centralized platforms that from these big tech companies who then have all of this power to do whatever they want. And we don't have to do that. There are many great alternatives to all of these platforms that are providing a better service to their users that are built on tech that is much better than what big tech is running on. There's no reason for us to put ourselves in that position.
That kind of gives me hope in a way too, that like, you know, big tech, for all their power and their control over our lives right now, are kind of like, they're kind of built on a shoddy foundation. What is that foundation that they're built on? And what's the foundation that we could instead build our whole internet on?
These tech companies are built on traditional relational databases. For example, things like MySQL and PostgreSQL. And these aren't necessarily bad per se, but they also are not a solid foundation for building software that has the properties that we're looking for. In other words, software that is hard to tamper with, software that follows a strict set of rules that you can rely on and depend on, and know that, you know, if somebody has a political grudge against you, that they won't be able to manipulate the software. What these centralized databases allow these companies to do is they allow them to mess with the data in any way that they want. They allow them to create this virtual world and iterate very quickly. Like there's an upshot. There's a reason why these big tech companies started out using these databases to begin with. And that is that it's really fast to get up and running and to make changes. It's much more difficult to design a decentralized protocol that has all the features that you want and then lock yourself into that and be like, okay, well, this is the platform that we're going to be using from now on and hope that there's not going to be any problem with it because, well, we can't make changes after the fact. So you can see why a lot of these big tech companies have made these decisions. But the thing is that they don't have to continue making these bad choices. They have the money now to make the right choice, but they're not doing it. There are other people who have forsaken the, you know, the quick get rich quick sort of path, or the become a huge $1 billion company path, and decided that they're actually going to stay small, and that they're actually going to do things in a way that avoids the mistakes of the big tech companies.
You founded the OK Turtles Foundation, right?
Yeah.
Why did you found the OK Turtles Foundation, and what are you doing? Like, how are you trying to build that other foundation?
So the OK Turtles Foundation is a nonprofit that focuses on beneficial decentralization technologies. And it does this through education, research, and development. So we research what types of decentralization technologies exist. We write articles about them, and we also create our own. And that's kind of our mission, is to help the world and other people think in a decentralized way. How can we avoid some of the pitfalls of centralized systems? How can we create more robust, reliable, dependable systems through decentralized thinking?
What is it that you're building right now that I think can kind of, excuse me for being dramatic, but kind of like lead the revolution? Like, I see this as like, it's like the Google Slayer.
It started off with us building an app called Group Income, and we wanted to do it in this correct way that I've been discussing. And we decided to create a framework to build this app. And for building all apps, not just Group Income, but all apps in a way that's end-to-end encrypted and decentralized, and also user-friendly at the same time. So that is a journey that we've been on for almost 10 years now, and we are pretty much getting ready to release it into the hands of other fellow developers who can then use it to build their own apps. That project is called Trilonia. It's a framework for creating apps. In other words, what's a framework? When a developer goes and they want to create a new app, they typically look for something called a framework, or in other words, a way of doing things, a pre-existing set of software and tools for creating applications. You know, one of the most famous frameworks, most popular frameworks, at least back in the day, maybe not so much nowadays, was called Ruby on Rails. So we're doing something similar, except it is for a way to build apps in an end-to-end encrypted, decentralized way. And that's what Trilonia is. It's a set of tools for any developer to create an app that's end-to-end encrypted and decentralized.
Why is that exciting for me? I'm just like a regular person who uses apps, right? I'm not a developer or anything. But why is it exciting? What is Trilonia going to change about the way I interact with the internet?
Well, it's going to remove some of the bad headlines that you see, I think. So some of the, you know, big headlines that, oh, such and such a company got breached and all of, you know, 10 million of their customers' data was stolen and it's now available on the black market. And by the way, change your password, you know, that kind of stuff. It's going to significantly mitigate, if not completely do away with. Probably not completely do away with, but it's going to significantly reduce that. It will empower developers. One of the big problems that developers have today, and one of the reasons why we see all of these apps today that are built in this broken way is because it's really difficult to do it the right way. You know, it's why we've spent 10 years working on this app. Like, it's not fair to ask every single developer out there to spend 10 years creating end-to-end encrypted decentralized framework before they can create an app that, you know, I don't know, manages their contacts, right? Like, that's a little bit unreasonable, I think. So we've done kind of the heavy lifting for them so they can take our work as a starting point and then build on top of that the actual app that they want to create. And then they can tell their users, hey, our app is decentralized. It is end-to-end encrypted. They'll be able to create new kinds of apps that haven't been possible before while still being user-friendly. I think that that's really cool.
I think one of the things that excites me is we were talking about this and you were like, any app you're using right now could just be built on this framework, right?
That's right.
So I think that one of the things that, you know, maybe people are hesitant to use the, you know, the apps right now that are end-to-end encrypted is you're going to be able to fill maybe some of your needs with those apps, but maybe it's like not every app that you have is going to be able to be an end-to-end encrypted, decentralized, secure app. But now that's actually possible.
All of the apps that people see out there that are that they're using on a day-to-day basis, somebody will be able to take that app and then convert it into an end-to-end encrypted, wow, decentralized version of that app.
That's crazy. Like, that's going to change the world.
I hope so, yeah.
I mean, it's something, why wouldn't a developer now, if they have this available? Because you said the big obstacle was just, I don't have the time to put into developing the framework, you know. I don't have 10 years to put aside, but now you guys have done that. You guys have put in, you've spent 10 years down in the mines, you know, unearthing this gem for us. So why wouldn't somebody use it now?
Well, one of the reasons why they might decide not to use it is because they will have to completely change the way that they do things. They will have to learn a new set of tools and do it and build their app in a completely different way. But I think a lot of people will make that choice because developers already have to do that. It's like almost every single day that a new JavaScript framework comes out and, you know, that's better, faster, or whatever. And people do make the switch. And especially as new generations start to develop new software, they're going to look for, you know, whatever is the latest and greatest tool that they want to be able to use to make their app the best. And so I think that we will see a new generation of apps come online that actually do respect people's privacy, that won't have to lie to their users and say, oh, we really take your security seriously, you know, wink, wink. You know, they'll be able to say it with a straight face.
That's amazing. Why did you decide to be the person who made this happen?
I didn't want to lie to my users. That's one reason. I also happened to have the background that was necessary to be able to do this. I started out creating software that helped people protect their data on their Mac using encryption. And I thought to myself, well, great. Now I've solved the problem of how to encrypt my data locally on my Mac, but my data is still not encrypted when it leaves my Mac. So that's kind of like the next leg of the encryption journey is like, once I've encrypted the data locally, I need to be able to encrypt it as it's traveling over the tubes, over the internet. It would be great if it could be encrypted there too. And it's been a many, many year journey to make that happen.
I wonder if I just kind of want to understand literally what happens to my data. Like, let's say I am sending a message to you, right? Let's imagine like my message is like a sheep and it's in my pen at home. And now I'm letting it out of the pen. What does it happen? What has to happen in order for it to get into your pen?
Oh my goodness. Well, that's a really great metaphor and obviously brings in the imagery of wolves attacking the sheep on its way from your pen to my pen.
Oops.
Yeah. That's pretty much what happens with data as it traverses the internet today is that it can be intercepted, it can be modified, it can be, you know, destroyed as well with censorship, for example. So
somebody could take my sheep and swap it for another sheep.
Somebody could take your sheep and swap it for another sheep. Yeah. So what needs to happen is your sheep needs to be guarded with cryptography, or, you know, in this case, the metaphor goes, it needs to be, something needs to prevent someone from intercepting the sheep and changing it into a different sheep, as you say. That's called the man in the middle attack. That's something that, you know, I've been focused a lot on, you know, when designing these protocols. And properly designed protocols can defend your sheep. It's possible. It's hard, but it's possible.
Okay, so let's say I'm not using an end-to-end encrypted messaging platform. What's, like, I'm sending my sheep out. What's going to happen? Or maybe it gets there safely, right? But what could happen to it?
Well, what could happen to it is that it could be eaten, in which case that's censorship. It could be transformed into something that no longer looks like a sheep. That's called the man in the middle attack. And it, or actually that's more like an active man in the middle attack, where the data is transformed. A passive man in the middle attack is just that somebody notices that your sheep is there. And it makes a note, you know, your sheep was in this location at this time, et cetera, and uses that for whatever purposes that they want. So that's kind of the sheep journey of today's data.
Now, let's say I've got the end-to-end encryption on, you know, let's say we're on a messaging platform that was built with Chelonia, and we know that our data is safe. What happens? What does our sheep's journey look like now?
Right. Well, it's not just messaging platforms. I want to make sure people understand this, because when people talk about end-to-end encryption, like, the context that term has been used in so far has always been messengers. But it doesn't have to be just messengers. I want to see a version of Google Calendar that's decentralized and end-to-end encrypted. There's no reason for Google to know about my dentist appointment, right? They don't need to know where I'm going to be at such and such a time, or who I'm going to be having a meeting with. They don't need to know this information. Or my contacts, for example. The company doesn't need to have a complete list of my Rolodex to know everybody that I've ever met. They don't need that information. So with this sheep journey, when it's using end-to-end encryption, you can protect your sheep. You can make it so that nobody even knows there's a sheep there. That's the end-to-end encryption version of the sheep.
People always say, I was just talking about donuts, and then I got served up an ad for donuts. Like, is your phone literally listening to you through the microphone? Does it hear the things you're saying, the conversations you're having?
There have been some companies that have been caught doing that, so it might be the case. It really depends on whether or not the company that is selling you your phone has done a good job of locking down the phone and making sure that these apps can't get permissions to listen in while they're off, etc. You know, these stories have been around, and especially when people decide to purposefully enable some of these always on listening features like, hey, Alexa, hey, Siri, you know, all this stuff like that. That you open yourself to that kind of scenario, to being surveilled and served relevant ads.
Greg, I think one of the big developments that's happened in the last 2 years is obviously just the growth of AI. We have like AI image, now pretty good AI video generators, AI voices. You can literally clone someone's voice and put words in their mouth, right? I'm wondering, just from your perspective, what are the consequences or the possible consequences of just where AI has gotten for our digital security?
Yeah, that is going to be a major problem, I think. That is going to be something that we are going to have to grapple with and find solutions to. It's almost like the next frontier of some of the tech-related problems on the horizon is all of this deepfake stuff. Because, yeah, it is trivial today to clone anyone's face, anyone's voice, and make it seem like that person said that thing. And I think that that is both a good thing and a bad thing. It is a good thing that it is so well known now that that is a possibility. And it is obviously a bad thing because it can be abused.
Mm-hmm.
It can be used to mislead and manipulate people, and it most likely will be used for that purpose. And so we're going to have to find solutions to that, both social solutions to that as well as technical solutions to that.
What is the biggest AI problem that you see coming in terms of security and privacy on the internet?
Yeah, I think deepfakes are probably near the top of that list, because they can be deployed by individuals as well as governments, and they can be used to completely sway society one way or the other over some particular contentious topic. They can be used to fake what a politician says. In the future, there could be better solutions to this, but right now they're just going to have to increase awareness of this possibility and improve their protocols for handling these situations. That's really the best thing they can do right now, is they have to game it out. Like, well, say our, the head of our treasury department, say their likeness is used to make a phone call to somebody to spoof their phone number along with their voice and to, say, write a check for $1 million and send it to this bank account. You know, how do we deal with that problem? The company will actually have to put their employees through the training necessary to deal with that kind of situation. And other companies are also going to have to deal with this, especially video hosting platforms, like including big tech platforms, are having to grapple with this already. Because if somebody uploads a video of some big YouTuber doing, you know, something that they never did, that's going to be a problem as well. So how does big tech handle that? I think that, you know, that's going to become an increasing problem in the coming years.
Is there any technical solution to this?
Yeah, there are technical solutions to this. One solution is to have a better control over their accounts and also use digital signatures, like especially if they're on a social network where they're, even for social networks that are centralized, for example, that people use. One thing that can be done is if you have, and creators already do this actually, they don't have a presence on just one social network. They usually have presences on multiple social networks, so that if their X account is compromised, they might have a backup on Instagram, for example. So that's thinking decentralized. Mm. You know, decentralize your identity and have a backup on all of these different places, so that if any one of your identities gets compromised, the other identities can report it and vouch for it and be like, I didn't actually say that. You know, this is my account was hacked. That's one way that they can deal with that. Other ways are, well, make sure that your company has secure lines of communication that are difficult to compromise, using end-to-end encrypted messengers, for example, or whatever else the case may be, so that they can double check. I know you just called me and asked me to make, you know, a check for $1 million out to such and such a corporation. Did you actually send this to me? You know, if you can have a direct secure line of communication with them.
Our original reason for wanting to sit down and have this conversation was because of this idea, X removed my like. And so the CEO of X has this quote where she said something like, you have the right to freedom of speech, but not freedom of reach. So can you unpack that quote a little bit and tell us about it?
Yeah, it's kind of a two steps forward, one step backward kind of deal, where the old Twitter, it was called Twitter back then, regime, was not liked by a significant portion of the users because it was very heavy on the ban and censorship button. And so the idea behind the company being bought out by Elon Musk, the reason that he gave was because he wanted to save freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. And so, yay, Elon buys Twitter, renames it to X, and unbans a select few accounts. Not everyone, but some accounts. And people are rejoicing because it seems like freedom of speech is being restored. But then we find out that there are these, you know, there's an asterisk on this whole story. It's freedom of speech, but not freedom of reach. And, oh, wait a second, some accounts are still being banned for things that maybe they shouldn't be banned for. And, you know, it's really difficult for any company, not just X, so I'm not even particularly blaming them, to run a social network of that size and scale and do a perfect job of it all of the time. This is why I'm an advocate for decentralized social networks, is because they're much better at moderation. You know, I for example, host my own Fediverse server. I don't have to deal with any moderation issues at all, because all of the accounts are accounts that I am personally responsible for, basically. So I don't have random people signing up and posting stuff that I don't agree with, or, you know, have to ban them. And that's something that is possible with decentralized social networks. You can be your own ex-CEO, basically. So with this freedom of speech, freedom of reach thing, you know, we see today that there is a lot of continued censorship on X, but it's also gotten more subtle and more insidious in some ways. I already mentioned, for example, the issue with parts of conversations being removed and missing. So that's a problem. But there's also this problem of the perception of popularity of content being manipulated as well, because that's not the only thing that Twitter can do. They can't just, not only can they censor and remove and hide replies, but they can also completely manipulate the stats of any tweet. So this is what happens when you build your software out of sand. You know, the floor isn't stable. When you're building on top of these centralized databases where there are no hard and strict rules on what can and cannot happen, anything can happen. And the company can decide, well, this person's content will be popular. This person's content will not be popular. Or this person's content will be popular at this moment, and we will forget about this other person's content. They have the ability to do all these kinds of things. They have the ability to literally remove your like. If you search on Twitter for X removed, if you search on X for X removed my like, you'll see a lot of people complaining that, hey, they like that tweet, but now their like has been removed. Well, what's up with that? That's some really shady manipulation going on there. So that's the kind of stuff that's possible with these platforms that aren't built on decentralized protocols.
So we're talking today because you are a data security person.
Yeah.
Because that's your background. What was it that made you want to do this with your life?
So I saw that's a really good question. The original impetus for wanting to build that software that protected people's data on the Mac, that came from me observing the harm that was caused by government overreach, going into people's lives and deciding to put people in prison for crimes that weren't really crimes. People just deciding, for example, that they wanted to smoke weed, right? They wanted to have a conversation with somebody in an unencrypted way, and then that would then land them in jail for however many years, destroying their lives because they wanted to smoke some grass. That, to me, was wrong. I could see it creating a whole lot of harm in communities, a whole lot of resentment as well, a whole lot of broken families. And, you know, although I do not condone illicit drug use, I also do not condone destroying people's lives over illicit drug use either. Like, these are, that seems worse to me, to be honest. Like, you're saying they might destroy their life, so let's go ahead and destroy their life right now, you know, because they might do it in the future. It's a little bit absurd to me. So that was the original impetus for working on encryption software.
And then you took some first steps, and then, how are you sure that, okay, this is right for me? Was there, an early time where you, created something where you were like, this works. This is something that I see actually accomplishing, something in the world.
I remember watching movies, Hollywood movies, where there would be some scene with a hacker, and then somebody would try to get into a computer and double click on a folder, and there would be a password prompt that they'd have to, bypass or whatever. And I looked around and I didn't see any software that did this. So I was like, huh, that's a really cool idea for a user interface. Why don't we just make it so that when you double click on a folder, you can get a password prompt. And so I did that. Mm-hmm. That was the first couple of versions of espionage that actually intercepted at the kernel level a click in an access to a folder. It would bring up a password prompt so that, it worked exactly like in the movies, in other words.
I actually didn't know that that wasn't a pre-existing, I guess everything was invented at some point. But I think that's so cool that you saw a movie and you were like, I'm going to make that happen.
Yeah.
What should give me hope about the future that we can build as just a regular person using the internet?
Well, what should give you hope is that developers are listening to your complaints. When you complain about how your data is being abused by big tech And when you complain online about all of the ways that big tech is manipulating your newsfeed and all of these things, developers are, in fact, listening. And they've been listening for a while, and they've been building solutions. And now the ball's actually in your court. All you got to do is use their tools.
Amazing. Greg, this has been an amazing conversation. I always learn so much from you all the time. If we want to learn more about Chelonia, if we want to learn more about the OK Turtles Foundation or Group Income, how do we learn more? How can we get involved?
So follow us on our social media accounts. So we are on X. You can follow OK Turtles on X and all of its related projects, including Group Income. You can follow OK Turtles on the Fediverse, so more commonly known but incorrectly known as Mastodon. That's just one implementation of one world of the Fediverse. You can also follow us. That would actually be okturtles@crib.social. That's where we are on the Fediverse. You can also follow us on Blue Sky, which is an alternative to X. We're also okturtles there. And you can subscribe to our newsletter. It's a low-volume newsletter. We do not give your email out to anyone. And we're not going to spam your folder with a whole bunch of emails. Those are the ways you can get in touch with us and follow us, as well as participate in some of this work if you'd like to.
What is your call to action for just people like me, just people using apps on the internet?
Today, you can pick one app or service from big tech and replace it with a decentralized or end-to-end encrypted alternative. Whether it's email or a messenger or a social network, just pick one and replace it with something that's better.
Great. What if I'm a developer? What is like the one thing I can do today to work towards the world we're talking about?
If you're a developer, you could go to shelterprotocol.org and you can follow the OK Turtles to keep up to date on when we release Chelonia. We're getting close to releasing that into the hands of developers. You could right now begin to familiarize yourself with the new way of doing things. You can look at Group Income's source code, for example. You can see how Group Income works. You could try it out and you could convince yourself that actually, yeah, this is user-friendly enough for me to build an app that's, you know, similar to it that my users would love, that would protect my users' privacy and security.
And what's the biggest thing that you need right now in order to be successful?
So we would love to collaborate with creators, people who can put the word out, for example, about what we're doing. And of course, we're a nonprofit, a 501c3. If you would like to financially support our work, if you're able to do that, that would be a big help too.
Cool. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you, John.